Genesis chapter number 8. Genesis chapter number 8, just continuing our series through the book of Genesis. This is message number 9 in that series, entitled Promises Kept. So we'll be looking at Genesis chapter 8, verses 1 to 22, the whole chapter. And so we'll start out by reading verses 1 to 4. And God remembered Noah and every living thing and all the cattle that was with him in the ark. And God made a wind to pass over the earth and the waters assuaged. The fountains also of the deep and the windows of heaven were stopped, and the rain from heaven was restrained. And the waters returned from off the earth continually. And after the end of the 150 days, the waters were abated. And the ark rested in the seventh month, on the 17th day of the month, upon the mountains of Ararat. So the last words of the Old Testament were written around 430 to 420 B.C. These would be the books of Nehemiah and Malachi. And at the time, there were Jews that were living in Judea that had returned much earlier than that, about 100 years and so. And they were under the rule of the Persian Empire and kings Artaxerxes I and Xerxes II. This was about the time the Old Testament writing was finished. And nearly 100 years after that, and so 300 years before Christ was born, a young student of Aristotle succeeded his father, Philip II, as the king of Macedonia. And his name was Alexander the Great, or, well, he was really Alexander the Second, I believe, but Alexander the Great is how he's known to us in history. He was only 20 years old when he began reigning, and that was in 336 B.C. Alexander was committed to the Hellenic vision that his father had before him, the idea of all of Greece being freed from the control of the Persian Empire, as well as the goal of Hellenizing the world with Greek culture. Soon after becoming king, Alexander began the military campaigns, which he would be most famous for and most remembered for. And within 2 years, he had actually conquered Darius III and the Persian Empire. And in just over 10 years, he had conquered and created one of the largest world empires in history, covering all the way from Greece to northwest India. Alexander the Great never lost a battle. He was never defeated in any battle that he fought. But his reign only lasted about 12 to 13 years because he died in the palace of Nebuchadnezzar II in Babylon in 323 B.C., around the age of 32 to 33 years old. Now, this was a little over 300 years before the birth of another king in Bethlehem of Judea named Jesus. But Alexander's vision wasn't just power. Now, obviously, he sought power, but it wasn't just power. He wanted to Hellenize the world, and he succeeded in many ways. In fact, much remnants of the Greek culture, particularly in the Western world, are still evident to this day, but not quite all the way. Alexander is regarded as one of the greatest military commanders of all time, and had he lived longer, he would have probably been the undisputed greatest. But you see, that's just the problem, isn't it? Alexander commanded men and conquered nations, but he couldn't conquer the curse, and he couldn't conquer the grave. Alexander's death is a little bit of a mystery. There are some varying accounts, although the accounts have a lot of similarity, so we feel like we have a pretty good account, but some details might be maybe different. But back in Babylon, he had spent a night and a day drinking strong wine, after which he developed a fever and some intestinal pain and acute weakness. There are some that suggest that he was maybe poisoned, and others have suggested a number of diseases that he may have contracted. But either way, Alexander couldn't have lived long by the way that he lived. For over a decade, he had engaged constantly in battles. He had received many severe wounds. He drank wine heavily and probably a part of that was because of the wounds and things that he received in battle. No army ever defeated him, but the curse of men defeated him in the end. Well, this highlights something that we have seen since the beginning of Genesis till now. You see, God established his kingdom on the earth that he created in the beginning. And he marked off the garden in Eden as the capital of his kingdom. And that's where he placed Adam and Eve. And he installed Adam there as king to rule the earth and commissioned them to fill the earth and to rule it as the imagers of God. But Adam failed in this task, and he forfeited the kingdom when he sinned, and they were both put out of the garden, and they were denied reentry. The very ground became cursed because of Adam, and he was destined to die. You see, God's kingdom did not continue on the earth. He destroyed the earth with the flood. Now, after the flood is a new beginning of sorts, but not entirely. Noah cannot be the second Adam, because he was still subjected to the curse. The kingdom of God on earth can only be established by the coming of the true second Adam, who will conquer the curse, who will conquer men, who will conquer the grave, who will conquer death, and who will conquer hell. So the kingdom only comes when the king who is alive forevermore comes to earth with fire and sword. So Genesis 8 and 9 now show that Noah was not the seed of the woman. Noah was not the second Adam, but he is still important in God's purposes, and that certainly comes out. So chapter 7 gives us the account of the flood that covered the entire earth, and the earth was plunged into a watery chaos, and the dry land was covered, and this destroyed plant and animal and human life on the earth. Now, this flood was God's judgment on the earth. And the flood provides us with concepts and patterns and vocabularies vocabulary and imagery to foreshadow future judgments and ultimately the day of the Lord judgment that is still yet to come. Now, we see this quickly in Genesis and Exodus with the judgment on Sodom and Gomorrah. In other words, how the flood foreshadowed that judgment. And there's references back to that time. And with the judgment on Egypt and the plagues and also at the Red Sea. And we can also, again, see some connections back to the flood story. So as we read chapter 8, we find the flood also foreshadows not just judgment, but salvation. Now, the word for salvation that's used throughout the Bible, both in Hebrew and the Greek, essentially means rescue. It means deliverance. And with Noah, we see the rescue from judgment. And that rescue theme continues in Sodom and Gomorrah account, even in the account of the Exodus. But chapter 8 focuses on the aftermath of the flood. The judgment has been accomplished at this point. And so now there's a focus on the aftermath and on the future and on that rescue that Noah and his family have received. But chapter 8 also highlights the faithfulness of God, but particularly the faithfulness of God to himself. And I know that we don't oftentimes think of it that way, but that is the God that is revealed to us in the Bible. He is faithful to his own word. And of course, that means then he is faithful to those he has promised. He's loyal, faithful to his own word. And that comes out in Genesis chapter 8 as well. So as we look at this chapter, we're going to break it into two pieces. In verses 1 to 14, we get Noah waiting. And in verses 15 to 22, Noah worshiping. So we'll start with this first part, and we're going to read verses 1 to 5, where we're told that God remembered. And God remembered Noah and every living thing and all the cattle that was with him in the ark. And God made a wind to pass over the earth and the waters assuaged. The fountains also of the deep and the windows of heaven were stopped, and the rain from heaven was restrained. And the waters returned from off the earth continually. And after the end of the 150 days, the waters were abated. And the ark rested in the seventh month, on the 17th day of the month, upon the mountains of Ararat. And the waters decreased continually until the 10th month. In the 10th month, on the first day of the month, were the tops of the mountains seen. So we're told here, right at the very beginning, and God remembered. And the word for remembered that is used means just what the English word remembered means. It's to think on. It's to call to mind. And it is common language that is used for God, both forgetting and remembering, throughout the Scriptures. Now, we're also taught, of course, that God is all-knowing. He is omniscient. He knows everything. And so there really is no, there's no forgetting with God, just as there's no remembering. Things are eternally present to Him. But those terms are used with God. It's often associated with God's covenant. And that is the case here, as God's covenant with Noah is given in the last part of this chapter, as well as the first part of chapter number 9. So when we encounter statements that God remembered, and sometimes we encounter prayers asking God to remember, that's common that we see in the Psalms. When we see those kind of statements and we read those kind of prayers for God to remember, we have to understand that is based on God's word. In other words, God has made some sort of a promise. God has made some sort of a covenant. He has made some sort of a promise by which He is stated to remember or is being asked or petitioned to remember. So it references His promises, which, if He fails to fulfill them as He promised, that would mean He was unfaithful. And that would in fact mean that He was not God. Now, back in Genesis chapter 3 and verse 15, God promised the seed of the woman who would crush the head of the serpent. So God promised a man born of a woman would conquer Satan and the curse to rescue men and women from it. Now, Eve thought that maybe Seth was that seed. Lamech, Noah's father, thought that maybe he was the seed. But neither of those were, and that means that the seed was still yet to come. But you go back to chapter 6, and we read how grieved that God was with the creation. So Genesis chapter 6, verses 6 to 7, it says, "And it repented the Lord that He had made man on the earth, and it grieved Him at His heart. And the Lord said, I will destroy man whom I have created from the face of the earth, both man and beast, and the creeping thing, and the fowls of the air, for it repenteth me that I have made them." But there's a problem here. Because if God were to destroy all mankind, that would leave His seed promise unfulfilled. That would mean that God was unfaithful, that He is not, in fact, God, that He has revealed Himself to be. So we also read in Genesis chapter number 6 and verse number 8, "But Noah found grace in the eyes of the Lord." So what does this mean? Well, it means that God chose Noah to preserve the seed promise. God is not abandoning that promise. God is not canceling that promise. He's not saying, forget about that. We'll just start again entirely new and we'll do something different. We'll do something better this time. You know, oftentimes we get to that point. We get frustrated or disappointed in something that we're trying to do. And we realize, okay, this is a place where we just need to stop and we just need to start from scratch and hopefully do something that works better the next time. But that's not the case with God. So God had promised this seed of the woman, but if He destroyed all mankind from off the earth, that seed promise would have been unfulfilled. And so we're told Noah found grace in the eyes of the Lord. So God had chosen him in order for that promise to be fulfilled. And God also promised to make a covenant with Noah. In chapter 6 and verse 18, "But with thee I will establish my covenant, and thou shalt come into the ark, thou and thy sons and thy wife and thy sons' wives with thee." So when we read Genesis chapter 8, and it tells us that God remembered, and God remembered Noah specifically, it's talking about all of these instances that we have leading up where God has made promises. And what are God's promises? Well, God's promises are not His wishes, and they're not His hopes. God's promises are merely expressions of His plan. This is what God has purposed to do. And He assures beforehand that He's going to do it. That's the promise of God. So God, remembering Noah, also gives us this note of completion. In other words, as we start into chapter 8, even though the earth is still covered with the waters, the flood has accomplished the purpose for which God had sent it. He sent the flood for judgment. He sent the flood to destroy life on the earth, and that has happened. That is what has been accomplished. So stopping the flood is what we read about as we go on in these verses at the opening of Genesis chapter number 8. God begins to alter, he begins to pull back these conditions of the flood that are leading to the water continuing to cover the earth. And really what we have a description of is the establishment of the hydrological cycle on the earth that we know today. And we also know from reading that it was different from what was in the pre-flood time, from the creation to the flood, when there was no rain, there's a mist that's watering the earth, there's a water vapor canopy that surrounds the earth, and we see that that has been changed as a result of the flood. So now we get wind and water and evaporation, and we get drainage of water through streams and rivers and seas and et cetera. So what we see in this opening is that, and this note of God remembering, is this sense of completion. The flood has accomplished the purpose for which God sent it. And now he is putting things into order, an order that is going to continue, as we will see by the end of this chapter. So the waters receded to the point, we're told, where the ark run aground on Mount Ararat, which is in modern-day Turkey, in the area of Armenia. And Noah and his family and the animals aboard had to wait. In fact, it seems quite drawn out as you get reading through chapter 8, especially this first half of it, that they have to wait. There's this many days and then this many days, and the waters are down this much, and then there's this many days, and then the waters are down this much. They had to patiently wait as these waters continued to recede. Now, picking up in verse 6, let's go to verse 12. And it came to pass at the end of 40 days that Noah opened the window of the ark which he had made. And he sent forth a raven which went forth to and fro until the waters were dried up from off the earth. Also he sent forth a dove from him to see if the waters were abated from off the face of the ground. But the dove found no rest for the sole of her foot. And she returned unto him into the ark, for the waters were on the face of the whole earth. Then he put forth his hand and took her and pulled her in unto him into the ark. And he stayed yet other 7 days. And again he sent forth the dove out of the ark. And the dove came in to him in the evening, and lo, in her mouth was an olive leaf plucked off. So Noah knew that the waters were abated from off the earth. And he stayed yet other 7 days and sent forth the dove, which returned not again unto him any more. So in these verses now we get this account of Noah sending out these birds to see the condition of the earth. And the account that we read here is a consistent record as we keep reading these numbers. Again, I've pointed this out before, but we keep getting all of these numbers that are given to us, and it's a consistent record with this number of days. In other words, it's an actual real account. It's a historical account. It is, we're able to trace the amount of time that they were on the ark and so on. But also, all of these numbers reveal to us a pattern that witnesses to the fact that this is the result of a detailed, predetermined plan by God and by his providence in executing all of his plan. So, for instance, we get this pattern that sort of repeats. And so back in chapter 7, you get 7 days of waiting on the ark, followed by chapter 7, verse 4. Followed by 7 days of waiting for the flood to come, chapter 7, verse 10. You get 40 days of rain and the flood in verse 17. Then you get 150 days of water prevailing over the earth in verse 24. Then we come into chapter 8 and we get 150 days of water receding in verse 3. We get 40 days of waiting in verse 6. And then we get 7 days of waiting in verse 10 by 7 more days of waiting in verse number 12. So again, we get this pattern that shows a design. It shows a process, almost again like with the creation. And there's a number of of connections between this account and the account of the creation, and it's all very methodical. In other words, it has been designed and determined before, and all these events are happening as God designed them to happen. So Noah sends out these birds. He sends a raven and he sends a dove to see if the waters have receded and what the state of the vegetation growth on the earth is. Now the raven, we're told, did not return, but the dove did. And so Noah perceived that the waters, well, they're still covering the earth. And he waited 7 days longer, and then he sent out the dove, and it returned with this leaf. And then he waits another 7 days, and he sends out the dove, and it does not come back. And so Noah knows that the waters have receded. And really what he's doing there is simply gauging the state of the earth and the recession of the flood and whether or not that the earth is inhabitable for he and the other animals as such that are on the ark. Then we get to verses 13 and 14. It says, it came to pass in the 601st year, in the first month, the first day of the month, the waters were dried up from off the earth. And Noah removed the covering of the ark and looked, and behold, the face of the ground was dry. In the second month, on the 7th and 20th day of the month, was the earth dried. So Noah had been on the ark. When you add all that up, he'd been on the ark for just over a year. But finally, everything was dry. The flood had receded. The earth was inhabitable for Noah and the land animals. But that didn't mean that Noah got off the ark just yet. And that brings us to the next part in verses 15 to 22, where we see Noah worshiping. Let's start here with verses 15 to 19. And God spake unto Noah, saying, go forth of the ark, thou and thy wife and thy sons' wives with thee. Bring forth with thee every living thing that is with thee, of all flesh, both of fowl and of cattle, and of every creeping thing that creepeth upon the earth, that they may breed abundantly in the earth, and be fruitful and multiply upon the earth. And Noah went forth, and his sons, and his wife, and his sons' wives with him, every beast of every creeping thing, and every fowl, and whatsoever creepeth upon the earth, after their kinds, went forth out of the ark. So we get now a command. God spoke again. And we've noticed a number of times as we've been going through this account where we keep getting this emphasis of God speaking. Back in the creation, we were told repeatedly that God said, and it was so. And then we get to the Noah account and we get God speaking and God telling Noah, commanding Noah, giving instructions to Noah, and Noah keeping, Noah doing. It was so, Noah doing just as God had commanded. So even as Noah determined that the waters had receded, that the ground had dried, the earth has once again become inhabitable, still yet, he receives the command to leave the ark, and then he leaves the ark. So, God commands Noah to bring out the animals so that they can inhabit the earth and they can fill the earth through reproducing. And God commands him, Noah and his sons and their wives and such, to come forth as well. Then we get to the altar that Noah built in verses 20 to 22. And Noah built an altar unto the Lord and took of every clean beast and of every clean fowl and offered burnt offerings on the altar. And the Lord smelled a sweet savor. And the Lord said in his heart, I will not again curse the ground any more for man's sake. For the imagination of man's heart is evil from his youth. Neither will I again smite any more every thing living as I have done. While the earth remaineth, seed time and harvest and cold and heat and summer and winter and day and night shall not cease. So we're told that Noah built an altar. Now, most likely, Noah set up some sort of an earthen altar or perhaps even a stone altar, taking some stones and piling them up, on which he was to offer his sacrifices. So as we look at what is taking place here, understand that this is a worshipful act of thanksgiving. This is a burnt offering that is to be given to the Lord, that is accepted by him as a sweet savor and so on. So he is acknowledging here, he's acknowledging God's goodness, he's acknowledging God's mercy. He's acknowledging God's faithfulness to keep His word, to keep His promises, as He has rescued Noah. He has brought him and his family, as well as all of these animals that he had on the ark. He has brought them through this flood for over a year, and he has sustained their life, and he has brought them back to an inhabitable earth. Now, we get the reference here to the clean beast. It says he took of every clean beast and of every clean fowl and offered burnt offerings on the altar. So obviously we see an association now when we noticed in the commands earlier for Noah to take these animals. He was to take of the seven pairs of the clean animals and two of the unclean animals. And we get this reference now again to these clean animals. And we see that there's an association now with clean animals and offering or sacrifice. Now, we still don't at this point get an explanation of what that clean and unclean distinction between these animals is and which animals belong to which group. And of course, that doesn't come until later in the Old Covenant law. So God was pleased, we are told, that it was a sweet smell. He smelled a sweet savor. God was pleased with this burnt offering and accepted it. That's, of course, language that is used later on in the Pentateuch, especially of the offerings and sacrifices that are made. And it's an indication of God accepting it, that God is pleased. God is satisfied with this offering that has been made. And this is a familiar phrase, the smelling of a sweet savor. As it's more often stated in other books of the Old Testament. But this also, here at the end of chapter 8 now, begins the covenant that God promised to make with Noah. And that's going to continue on into chapter 9 that we'll look at in the next message. But this is the beginning of that covenant. And so God says that I will not again curse the ground anymore for man's sake. For the imagination of man's heart is evil from his youth. Neither will I again smite any more every living thing as I have done. So notice that man is still fallen. So he has come through the flood, but man is still fallen. He is still descended from Adam. He is still a participant in Adam's sin and is still born inherently with his own sinful depravity. And that is still the case. Even after God has destroyed all life except for the eight people that were on the ark. So, man is still fallen. What does that mean? Well, that means that as life continues on the earth, it will once again be filled with evil as the evil imaginations of men will produce it, just like it was before the flood. So, God promises, or He covenants himself not to lay any more curse on the earth than what has already been placed on it, nor to ever again destroy all life on the earth as he did with the flood. That doesn't mean that God's not going to bring judgment on the earth, and in fact he is, and particularly in that day of the Lord that is going to be a judgment that's going to come on the whole earth in the future time. But it also doesn't mean that there would not be any more floods. What it does mean is that there would not be any more global floods. There would not be a flood like this one again. And of course, there are many localized floods that happen and sometimes do great damage and still continue to do today. But they are not global floods that destroy all life on the earth. Not only that, but God has promised in verse 22, while the earth remaineth, seed time and harvest and cold and heat and summer and winter and day and night shall not cease. So God has promised, he has covenanted himself to govern and to maintain the cycles of the earth. So just as we saw in the beginning of chapter 8, that God is establishing these cycles of the earth that are also a part of the seasons of the earth and a part of this growth and harvest and planting and all of that cycle that goes on. God has covenanted, he has promised to govern and maintain those cycles. So what he's promising to do is to give the earth stability. And he's given the earth this stability for his kingdom and salvation plan to be fulfilled. Now, once again, that doesn't mean that there are not localized droughts and floods and various problems. And sometimes we can even have problems that affect global distribution and such. But we don't have a worldwide famine, a worldwide flood. We don't have those sort of things. But God is maintaining this earth in all of its cycles in order for his plans to be fulfilled and ultimately for his kingdom to come to this earth through the true second Adam. Now, when we look at this account, we should not read any account of God's judgment without fear. In other words, any account of judgment that we read in the Bible, and particularly historical judgments, are certainly not something that we should overlook or think lightly of. This judgment foreshadows that great day of the Lord judgment that is coming on all the earth. It was a foreshadowing of many judgments that have come since then, like I mentioned at the beginning with Sodom and Gomorrah or on Egypt in the Exodus and many others as well, even that came upon Israel and came upon other nations like Assyria and such. God is a righteous and a holy God. And he is not to be taken lightly. And what do we do? Well, Jesus said that the rain comes on the just and the unjust alike. Paul commenting, saying that we misjudge those things. We misinterpret those things. We think that we're all right. There's nothing really to fear. There's nothing really to be concerned about. The sun just keeps on coming up and the wind, the rain comes and the snow comes and we plant the field and we reap the field and, you know, life just continues on. But that's exactly what God promised to happen. So this is a refusing to acknowledge God or a taking him lightly. As we think about Genesis 8, this account also highlights God's grace and his promises. Now, I imagine at some point in your life, you've made a promise that you didn't keep. I imagine all of us have done that. There's been some point in our life we've made a promise. We have said we were going to do something that we, in fact, did not do. Now, maybe that's because we simply forgot, and that can be easily done. Sometimes we can make promises without really thinking about it. We just sort of shoot off and promise, say we'll do something, and then we just forget that we ever even said that. Maybe you didn't keep your promise because you lacked the resources to actually do what you had said that you would do. And maybe you changed your mind. Maybe something about the situation or the circumstances, or maybe something that you had not foreseen, whatever it was, and you didn't keep a promise. You see, it's human nature to seek for and to allow for loopholes. And it's one of the reasons why modern contracts are so hard to read and so hard to decipher. Insurance policies, all of these kind of things, they're so difficult to understand, and the language and even laws and things that are passed, the language is left deliberately vague so that there can be ways around and workarounds and exits and all that sort of thing. See, men love to provide themselves with an escape clause so that if things are not to their liking to keep their word, then they can say, oh, hey, it says right here. And you never even thought that meant that or realized it said that. Well, that's very much human nature for us to say that we're going to do things, but always allow ourselves an out. But that is not the way that God is. That is not the way that God speaks. And that is not the way that God makes promises. When God makes promises, He keeps His word, even though it's repeated in this whole account that man grieved God with his sins. And even here, he says, I'm not going to again do this, even though man's heart is evil from his youth. In other words, it's not going to take long at all before we're going to be right back the earth filled with evil and violence again. So God keeps his word. And when we, of course, read forward in the Bible, we know what keeping promises will cost God. Though we may not just read Genesis 3:15, and if we don't know the rest of the Bible, we may not understand what that means. But that means the sacrifice, the giving of His only begotten Son to die for sinners. So we know what keeping promises is going to cost God, but yet it's not possible that He would not pay that cost, that He would not keep His promises. And so we should be assured, and we should be confident that God promises both judgment and salvation. He promises salvation to those who turn to Him in faith, those who believe, those who put their trust in Him. He promises salvation to those who do not, to those that put their trust in other things or other people or even themselves, those who will not acknowledge God or will deny Him or just think nothing of Him. He promises judgment. And here's enough for us to see that God keeps His promises.